This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My next guest today is the writer and longtime Chicago Sun-Times columnist Neil Steinberg. He has a new book out, A Day-by-Day History of Chicago and How the People of Illinois' Biggest City Affected the Rest of Our State, Our Nation, and Our World. It consists of 366 vignettes from January 1st to December 31st, covering moments high and low.
Barack Obama, Democrat for Congress, new leadership that works for us.
Paid for by Obama for Congress 2000.
Another shooting. This one Friday night, claiming the lives of two young mothers, Chantel Grant and Andrea Stoudemire. But this was not just another shooting, not here, a place where neighbors and the group called Mothers Against Senseless Killing vowed to keep safe.
The presentation of the championship trophy in just a moment. An emotional moment for Michael Jordan.
The book's title itself is something we're going to discuss, and I suppose I ought to offer a trigger warning to people who take literally and seriously the third commandment. It's called Every Goddamn Day, a highly selective, definitely opinionated, and alternatingly humorous and heartbreaking historical tour of Chicago. I should say I've been a fan and avid reader of Neil Steinberg's writing in the Sun-Times and on his blog for a long time now, and have been looking forward to this conversation. So, Neil, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, I want to invite you to join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. As we talk, I'm going to ask Neil about some of the dates he writes about in his book and some of the episodes. Maybe you have a date you want to give us as a prompt. It could be your birthday or anniversary or something. Or if you just have a question for Neil Steinberg, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. So, Neil, I thought we might begin with a few dates in the book just to get a flavor
sure.
for how you approach this. Let's begin with January 27th, 1967, and a big, big, big blizzard.
Everyone remembers that. I mean, it was the big snow. And, you know, when you tell a story that's familiar to everyone, it helps if you find a different way to tell it. And so as I was looking over the press clippings from that day, and the city just stopped, I realized that one thing that doesn't stop is having a baby. And there were lots of people having babies in all sorts of unusual circumstances that day. And so I kind of gave it a little bit of a Yiddish spin in the opening sentence. I said, babies don't know from snow. And that sort of draws you in, right? Anytime babies are being born under dire situation, you know, to me, that sort of holds your interest. So even if you know, yeah, the whole city stops, yeah, there was a lot of snow, it kind of adds the human element, which always pushes a story along.
And yeah, this is a story that's repeated, and this is a good point, right? My wife was born, 11 years after that in a different blizzard. The family lore has it that the ambulance was, you know, followed a snowplow to get to the hospital.
Right.
But this is not an uncommon story, right? You're telling a bigger story with this vignette.
I'm telling a story about the city. I mean, I was given the way this book came. Maybe we should pause a second, explain how this book happened. I have a blog called Every Goddamn Day where I write every single day. And the editors at the University of Chicago Press, which is sort of a revered academic press, I've done two previous books for them, and they said, could you do a book of Chicago history like your blog, where you tell stories keyed to the date? And it was sort of a challenge because, you know, it was sort of a, you know, to fill each box, so to speak. I mean, dates like January 27th, 1967 were sort of easy. The harder part was sort of certain dates, there just didn't seem to be anything attached to them. And in the introduction to the book, I kind of go into, you know, why are we doing this? You know, what's the point of reading this stuff? You know, for stories like the 67 blizzard, for a lot of people, it resonates. A lot of people weren't born in 67. And so I try to make each one into a little tale where you didn't have to be there. You don't really have to care about history to read it, but hopefully you learn something from it.
Yeah, and each one, I mean, it ranges from just a couple of paragraphs to a couple of pages, nothing too much longer than that. So let's pick another date, March 21st, 2000. We heard a little clip alluding to this earlier. This is the first and only time a certain Illinois politician loses a race.
Well, when someone is such a winner, you tend to assume he always was. And this is something, you know, this is only 23 years ago. I was working at the paper then. And it starts with sort of a very sort of a dreary image. It says only about 50 supporters show up at the Ramada Inn at 49th and Lakeshore Drive. Why would they? Nobody wants to hang around with a loser. And the quote, "I confess to you, winning is better than losing," Barack Obama tells them. "I thought maybe we could pull this off." You know, I remember very well sitting in the editorial board of the Sun-Times with Barack Obama written on a yellow legal pad. And I was expecting a guy with like a big fro and a dashiki to come in and throw me a power salute, you know, just based on the name. And so he surprised a lot of people. And I loved this moment because this is actually, you know, just as with Jane Byrne becoming mayor of Chicago was the only election she ever won, this was the only election that Barack Obama ever lost. And he learned a lot from it. He was a terrible candidate. He was thin-skinned and he was boring and he was, you know, he didn't like the handshake kind of thing. And but he learned. So he was running against Bobby Rush, remember, who was very well known, and his son Huey had been killed the month before, so there was a great sympathy factor. And people, you know, Obama was ridiculed even in the black community as basically like being a white man in blackface and being, I think Rush's line was, an educated fool. He went to Harvard and became an educated fool. And part of the themes of the book is that you have to really try. You know, it takes, you know, people look at him now and he's just like, you know, my nickname for him when he was running was God's chosen vessel, because he was someone who just like the seas parted to let him in. He took Carol Moseley Braun's Senate seat, and Carol had to really mess up big time to get kicked out of that. And then the people who were running against him, you know, Jack Ryan looked like Superman, and his wife was 7 of 9 on Star Trek. And then it turned out he was taking her to sex clubs, and he just vanished. And several other candidates had to blow up in his way. So anyways, it's sort of one of the themes of the book. When they asked me to write this, I didn't want to just do a random book of whatever dates I could find, but I had certain, you know, what's Chicago about? Well, it's race and it's labor and it's technology and it's transportation. You know, we were started as a portage, you know, before a single white man set foot here, the Native Americans were here because we were this little mile and a half muddy bog, this swamp in between the trickle of the Chicago River and the Des Plaines River, which heads down to the Mississippi. And so we were always a place where people, you know, changed first canoes and then trains. You know, I find a lot of consistency in Chicago history, and I like to sort of bring people into why this stuff is significant.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Neil Steinberg, who is a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times by day, in the evenings, or maybe in the daytime, I don't know. He also writes a blog, which is called Every Goddamn Day, and that is also the title of his latest book.
Can I tell you how that happened, Brian?
I want to ask about that. And I know a little bit of the history, but
it's not blasphemy. I actually have a lot, you know.
Note on your website sort of explaining that. So let's get into it. Go ahead.
My column used to appear 4 days a week in the Sun-Times and one day on Sundays in the New York Daily News. And I was talking to my boss and I said, look, I'm already writing a column 5 days a week. Why don't I write the other two? And here's your advertising tagline, Neil Steinberg, : every goddamn day, only in the Sun-Times. And I was telling that to someone and their eyes lit up. And they said, you know, this is when domain names were big. And they said, do you own the domain name for that? I said, no, but I bet you I can beat you to it. And I bought the domain name, everygoddamnday.com. And then the paper, so I mouthed off to the publisher and they suspended me. And so this was 10 years ago, and I fired up the everygoddamnday.com. I didn't know whether I was ever going to write another column again, but you know, here was something that I didn't have to push through the paper to get my voice out. And I really enjoyed it. Every goddamn day is just the start of it. I can parse certain words that I'm not going to say here. I can write about all sorts of aspects. And if, you know, every once in a while I'll do something that because of space in the physical newspaper will just be butchered. And I'm not that upset anymore because I can put it in the full form on my blog. And it's as a writer, it's a great comfort to, you know, usually editors are right, but sometimes they're not right. And sometimes they have to do things for other considerations. And I found it something I really enjoyed. So, you know, even though the book is only tangentially related to the blog, I felt very validated when the University of Chicago Press asked me to do this.
You know, I'm glad you're holding back on some of those other colorful metaphors, we'll say.
I live in Rome, Brian. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Yeah, hey, I'm sure my news, I can picture my news director right now white knuckling through this conversation.
No, I'm not going to get you in trouble. You know, if you didn't, other radio stations, they'll say every gosh darn day. I mean, the University of Chicago Press tried to buy ads on WFMT and they wouldn't take the money. They wouldn't run the ad. I thought that was ridiculous.
Well, you have a note on your website that this name is sort of a filter or litmus test, right?
Well, it became, I wish I was smart enough to have thought of that ahead of time. But after the fact, when I saw people complaining, I kind of said, look, this, you go on a roller coaster and there's that, are you tall enough? The measuring stick at the beginning. And that's what the name of the blog is. If this bothers you, well, don't read it. Everyone saw people will write it and they're just massively upset about something. And I try to answer them back. I say, but I didn't write it for you. There's plenty of stuff for you. Go to Fox News, go to church, go to whatever is tickling your fancy. I know this is a crazy thought, but there are other people who believe other things and they get to read that stuff too. And that's who I'm writing it for. I'm writing it for people like me who are sort of centrists who think about stuff, who have a wide range of beliefs, who change their mind about stuff. And, it's sort of an awkward middle sometimes. And I try to give people a fair, the paper once sent me, that's why I love being a newspaper columnist, because the paper will send me places. And when Trump was appearing down in Granite City at the U.S. Steel there, I went down and the column I sent back began, Donald Trump is a charming man and people like him. And people were just shocked. Why, and I said, look, I didn't drive 250 miles across the state just to regurgitate my own biases. I can do that sitting in my office. I spent 2 hours at this steel plant talking to the people there and they adore him. And that's, that's a fact. That's not fiction. And so, I like to reflect other opinions sometimes. And I'm very proud of that. I'm in the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame, but I'm not gay. And I got the Courage Award from the Council of American Islamic Relations, and I'm not Muslim. And I got the Italian Americans Dante Award, and I'm not Italian. So I can really, at least give consideration to other people. And I do that in the book as well.
A lot of journalists are pretty polite, if not reverent, in writing about religion, even if they're not religious. And I think this goes along with the title. You, in my experience, do not share that predilection. Have you always written that way?
I've never believed in God for a second. I can't even believe that other people do. It's such an incredible notion. That said, life's a long time and you need stuff. When my kid was 13, he didn't want to have a bar mitzvah. And I said, fine, don't have one. Go tell your mom, I'll support you 100%. However, we go to the opera, right? That's not true either. There's no Carmen. She doesn't work in a cigarette factory. It's a pretty story with good music, which is what religion is. And it really helps people. When someone's 9-year-old dies, I'm not going to argue whether they're in heaven or not. It's a very useful, comforting, and this gets back to being able to connect to other people. And there's ritual and there's pageantry. I went to Rome. I went to the Vatican. I was, it's fantastic. Look what people do. I'm a huge Dante fan, and you read the different things that religion is. I mean, to me, it's a hammer. That's the metaphor I use. Religion is a hammer. You can build a house, you can hit someone in the head and kill them. It's the same hammer. That's why people who are out, and then people try to use it to justify every bias, every smallness, every crime. And I call them out on it. On the other hand, I used to work Sundays. I've been in every church. I've been in an infinity of services. And they people do a lot of wonderful things. And the sad thing is that we're so polarized and we're so, tribal that people, there's no glory in defending your own group and a knee-jerk, praising yourself. That's Don Quixote. Self-praise is self-condemnation. And it is Cervantes, I'm curious about things. I love doing this book. When I turned this book in, I told the editor, I said, I so enjoyed writing this. You don't even have to publish it. I got my benefit already. And it's true. I learned so much about Chicago. And here I've been on staff for 35 years. I had no idea that the size of the city quadrupled in a day. I had no idea that Chicago had the first public school for kids with disabilities in 1900, that it was this whole progressive thing that was happening. And there's just so much, you know, I don't like to be, I mean, Chicago is not a world-class city. We're not Paris, we're not London, but we have a tremendous history. And I think it's really important, you know, if you want to know what's going on in the country and in the world now, you need to understand the labor history of Chicago. You need to understand the, and we are the black metropolis in the country. New York isn't the way we are. No other city is. And I think to look at the history of people coming here and of, you know, Martin Luther King here and the, and various, you know, why would you not, it's like not eating chocolate. Okay. Yeah. You can go through your life not eating chocolate, but why, you know? And so to me, to master and by dividing it into 366 little digestible, you know, you can read the book on the pod if you want. that's being a columnist. I have 750 words in the paper tomorrow. Today's Wednesday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the Sun-Times. And, you know, so if I, you know, I have to take something really complicated sometimes and boil it down into this little essence. And I do that with these, and, you know, some of these are vastly familiar, one of the ones I'm most proud of, is the Eastland. And it's a very familiar disaster in 15.
You know, I'm going to ask you to pause there because we need to take a break, and that is a good setup. We're going to talk about the Eastland. Maybe we can also talk about the Iroquois, which is one of my, it's a meaningful date in my life. I'll just say that, and what happened there. And I think it's kind of remarkable how much most people don't seem to understand or know about what happened in Chicago on that day. We're talking with Neil Steinberg, who is the author of the book Every Goddamn Day, a highly selective, definitely opinionated, and alternatingly humorous and heartbreaking historical tour of Chicago. You can also read him, as we just heard, Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the Bright One. Do they still call it the Bright One? The Chicago Sun-Times. We're going to continue our conversation here on the 21st show. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Chicago Sun-Times columnist Neil Steinberg. He's also the author of many books. Most recently, it's Every Goddamn Day, a highly selective, definitely opinionated, and alternatingly humorous and heartbreaking historical tour of Chicago. He also writes a personal blog of the same name. And if you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So the book has, you know, it has some sports. We heard the clip from the Chicago Bulls' fourth NBA championship. No Stanley Cups, as you point out in the introduction. A lot of that stuff's covered elsewhere. And you alluded to this earlier. How do you pick? I mean, you could have written probably 10-volume set of Chicago history.
Thought about cheating originally, like having a secondary event on some days. But I thought, no, part of history, you know, we make decisions that become history. And then we make decisions of what we present. And some days were very hard. August 15th was both the Battle of Fort Dearborn, as it's now known, or the unveiling of the Picasso in 1967. And I so love them. And this is where I have a saying as a writer that it's better to be lucky than good. And so sometimes you just luck out. And so with Fort Dearborn, you know, the Native Americans basically killing a bunch of soldiers there, it didn't just happen that morning. And so, you know, when you tell a story is significant. So if you go the day before, you've got Chief Partridge showing up at the fort and giving back his friendship medal to Captain Held and basically saying, I can't keep this because we're going to kill you all tomorrow, which changes the story significantly. I mean, that's one interesting thing about history is it changes every generation because we decide we're different people. You know, it used to be the Fort Dearborn Massacre because it was these, you know, whooping savages slaughtering these poor Chicagoans in Fort Dearborn. And then nowadays, of course, we try to give people more agency and we look at the Potawatomi and we think, well, what were they doing? Why did they do this? And so now instead of a massacre, it becomes a battle that the Chicagoans lost badly. And again, you know, says you see a lot of this. This is a big deal to people. You see people in Washington, people in Florida. They don't want to teach history that way. They want to have Parson Weems' fable. You know, you want to have George Washington off the dollar, chopping down the cherry tree, and the fact it never happened doesn't really matter. And to me, that's cowardly. I don't think there's anything to embarrass anybody in history. You know, I mean, I you know, I had a big debate whether to use the N-word in a story where it's key. And, you know, I don't think things should be whitewashed. I think people are adults in the main, and they can process what happened. And if you don't understand what happened, what hope do you have of understanding what's happening? And that to me was why history, you know, to me, history is like exercise. You should do it several times. You should do it every day to keep fit. And there's always more stuff to learn. Anyways, I'm not talking about the Iroquois fire, which you wanted to talk about.
No, we can come back to that. I like this, because you talk about this in the intro, right? This idea of the shifting perspective of history. People on the ships arriving, now it's those on the shore watching them arrive, and we see the biases of the past, as you say.
It's not about, like, I put out the flag. I'm an intensely patriotic American. I love this country. Okay, but that doesn't mean we're perfect. We make lots of mistakes. We're human, and then we try to correct those mistakes. You know, I was just reading Jonathan Eig's book on Martin Luther King for Martin Luther King Day, and that journey, that progress from slavery to holding on to American democracy even more than people who benefit most from it do. I mean, it's an incredible story that people should leap to be familiar with. And that was, I mean, that was the frustrating thing. I'm not a historian. And so a lot of these, I had to do sort of deep research to find out what happened. A lot of times I could talk to, you know, I didn't want this to be the white man's history of Chicago. So I made a point of saying, okay, what do I have about Mexicans? What do I have about Japanese? What do I have about Chinese? And in trying to find those stories, I found some amazing things. The racism in the city is incredible and forgotten. We just, you know, there were 26 bombings of black homes after World War I. You know, people live in these very segregated areas in Chicago for a reason. They were forced to. And so to turn around and say, oh, it's a choice. You want to live in Englewood. You want to be a criminal. I mean, that's just ridiculous. This is all, it's all systemic. And the evidence is sitting there in history books and magazine and newspaper clippings.
Yeah. Talk about January 28th, 1910 in this vein, leprosy in Oak Park.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. I was literally, this was one of the last things I found. And when I had an open date, I would go to the 101 years of the Chicago Daily News that are on computer, which is a tremendous resource to anyone who wants to do it. And what I found was a story, actually, this was from The Examiner, which was one of the independent papers, which was very feisty at the time. And it begins saying there's leprosy in Oak Park. There was a rumor that hit people were calling in concerned to the Chicago Examiner about leprosy. And this is supposedly what happened. A girl in Oak Park fell, hurt her elbow. Someone took a freshly laundered handkerchief that had been washed at a Chinese laundry and clamped it over her elbow, and she got leprosy because it was a Chinese laundry. It's ridiculous, right? We laugh at it now, but it wasn't funny then. And it people were boycotting and were attacking Chinese people. They were boycotting laundries and Chinese restaurants. And at the same time, it happened to be, and this is the odd sort of weird, twisted way history works. Our Chinatown was right downtown. It was at Clark and Van Buren. And because of racist pressure, it moved out to Wentworth and Cermak, where it had a lot of room to grow. And so Chicago has one of the most active, real, dynamic Chinatowns. It's not a tourist spot. I mean, it is, but it's also a place where Chinese people live and work and go to school. And it's because they were pushed out of the city in 1910. And so it's, you know, it's sort of an amazing way that people who are oppressed groups have a way of using the oppressions to their benefit. You know, anti-Semitism was bad in Poland in the 20s, but it got my grandfather here, and that was good. So, you know, it's, I tell a lot of stories like that. I have a story from the diary of a Nisei, of a Japanese American who had come to Chicago from an internment camp and was being resettled by the Quakers, and he takes the L across the city. One of the themes of the book is how people view us. Chicagoans can care a lot about how we're seen by other people. And so, you know, because I was trying to fill these dates, so I had this page from a diary of a Japanese American coming to Chicago for the first time, looking for somewhere to live. I have a page, I found a Mary, God, I can't think of her last name. She was a secretary in Rochester, New York, and she came here to go to the fair. And again, trying to plug the date, I found this breathless description. And it's like you're following this 28-year-old lady across the fair in 1893 of what she sees and smells and feels. And, you know, again, it was a beautiful, beautiful piece of living history that I would never have found had I not been trying to plug something into the date, right? It's better to be lucky than good.
We're speaking with Neil Steinberg, Chicago Sun-Times columnist. His latest book is called Every Goddamn Day. It's from the University of Chicago Press, a vignette, 366 days of history. Let's go to the phones, 800-222-9455. We've only got about 5 minutes left in the show. Paul is calling from Urbana on line one. Paul, briefly, thank you for calling in.
Sure. There was something called the Black Summer. It was just some black youth were trying to swim on the beachfront, and it led to like a white riot that went into the community. It was quite a pogrom, actually.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Paul, for bringing that up. I think, Neil, you do talk about this in the book. I remember reading something about it.
It was a very, very significant sort of city-jarring event that happened in 1919. It starts with a kid swimming off the black beach, and they float on a raft towards the white beach, and one of the beachgoers throws a stone and kills the boy, falls and drowns, and it led to 3 days of rioting. They had to bring in the army, and so supposedly Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, was in one of the youth gangs that and here, you know, as a historian, I had a dilemma, because a lot of times history wants to portray black people as complete victims. And while they did get the lower end of the stick in this riot, there were a number of white people killed as well. And you had both the Defender was printing all these wild untruths, and the Chicago paper, the white papers, were printing these wild untruths. And I had to sort of try to balance my presentation of it so that it was fair. You know, you've got an event where people of both races are grabbing each other and killing each other and burning each other's houses down. And it was a reminder to me that everyone suffers, although, you know, there was no question which was the oppressed class at that time. So, yeah, I'm just looking for the exact date. It's sometime in July of 1919, but I don't.
Yeah. And those incidents are another great example of what you talked about, reframing history. Right. Race riot is the term that was used for a long time. Now some of those are being called race massacres. You see that being applied retroactively.
What happened in Tulsa? It's definitely, and I didn't want to get caught up in the fine point. You know, wanted to point out that, you know, in 1919, you know, World War One, when soldiers went off to fight, African Americans flowed up to Chicago to take positions in factories and steel mills. And so, you know, I don't want to just make it seem like they were just this serf class living in misery, because they, you know, at first the beachgoers appealed to the police to arrest the guy who threw the stone. And then there was a black policeman there, and they did have a very complicated, very sophisticated and successful presence in the city. And I think that's why it's important to show what kind of balance there was, and not just show it as one group wailing on the other, which it also was.
You know, just a couple of minutes left in our conversation, and I think because of that, we're going to pass over the Iroquois Theater fire. People can look that up December 30th next time. We've been talking a lot about, you know, some of the more negative examples, but there's uplifting. There's Black Joy in this book. There's Siskel
Music,
Ebert.
Poetry.
Yeah, pick one of your favorite positive ones we can end on.
I love a lot of the technology. I have the unveiling of videotape at the Hilton Hotel in 1956, which was just at the Radio and TV Broadcasters Convention, where someone gives a speech, a CBS executive, and then they have these TV monitors, and they on the first VCR machine, they roll the tape back and they play the speech again, and there's basically a riot. And there's several instances of that. You know, the first cell phone is debuted in Chicago, and people are more familiar with the first atomic, you know, splitting the atom in 1943 in the University of Chicago. But what I really loved, you know, as a journalist, I asked the question, why was it here? Why would you split the atom? Why would you do this dangerous atomic experiment that Niels Bohr was worried would set the atmosphere on fire in the middle of a crowded college campus, in the middle of a city, in one of the most crowded cities in the country? And I answer that. And then, of course, they're halfway through and the Geiger counters are going, and it's this moment of high drama. And Enrico Fermi looks at his watch and says, oh, it's lunchtime. And they shut the experiment down and they go over to Hutchins Commons and have lunch. And I just love that detail because it shows there's still human beings doing this. And to me, it's a way to help you relate to history as well.
No, yeah, and this is really a book of people and how people influence history, not just a place. Neil Steinberg is a columnist. You can read him Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Chicago Sun-Times, also at his blog and in his latest book, both of which are called Every Goddamn Day. The book subtitle is a highly selective, definitely opinionated, and alternating humorous and heartbreaking historical tour of Chicago. You can find it online or in your local bookstore at all the usual places. Neil Steinberg, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st Show. I enjoyed this.
A lot of fun, Brian. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. Tomorrow on the 21st Show, before Roe versus Wade recognized a constitutional right to an abortion, women still found ways to end their pregnancies. In Illinois, that could mean seeking help from an underground feminist abortion service codenamed Jane. We had this conversation first time last year. Given that this weekend is the 50th anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision, we're going to revisit that conversation on tomorrow's 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Jose Zepeda and Christine Hatfield. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Anaya Jones, and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. If you like our show, you can share it with a friend. You can either share a segment from our website, 21stshow.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Just search for The 21st. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.